Greetings from Hamilton, Ontario, Canada. As we record this podcast, I recognize and acknowledge that I'm located on the traditional territories of the Mississauga and Haudenosaunee nations and within the lands protected by the Dish with One Spoon Wampum Agreement. I am Selina Mudawanu.
Greetings from Calgary, Alberta, Canada. I would like to take this opportunity to acknowledge the traditional territories of the people of the Treaty 7 region in southern Alberta. The city of Calgary is also home to Métis Nation of Alberta, Districts 5 and 6. I am Motilola Akinfemisoye Adejare.
Welcome to the Black Professors Podcast.
Selina and I are faculty members who are trained in media and communication studies.
And we worked in radio and television broadcasting at some point in our careers.
Our interests include digital storytelling, radio, and alternative media forms. On the podcast, Black professors will be asked about their pathways into academia and how they found themselves in their areas of specializations. They will also be asked to talk about the political, social, and other contexts that impacted their decisions to enter academia.
Further, they will be asked to share stories about their research and teaching trajectories, high and low lights in their careers, awards and grants they won, courses they developed, as well as their current research and teaching interests.
These professors will be invited to give advice to young people in Black communities and to their early career colleagues on successfully navigating the academy.
The professors will also be requested to speak about their favorite foods, hobbies, holiday destinations, as well as how they endeavor to maintain the work-life balance. Dr. Ingrid Waldron is Professor and Hope Chair in Peace and Health in the Global Peace and Social Justice Program in the Department of History, Faculty of Humanities at McMaster University. She is the founder and director of the Environmental Noxiousness, Racial Inequities and Community Health Project ENRICH, the co-founder and co-director of the Canadian Coalition for Environmental and Climate Justice, as well as the co-founder of Rural Water Watch.
Dr. Waldron's research interests include the impacts of anti-Black racism and other forms of discrimination on the health and mental health of Black communities, racial disparities in health and mental health related to COVID-19, dementia, and other illnesses, as well as the social, political, health, and mental health effects of environmental racism and climate change inequities in Black, Indigenous, and racialized communities.
Dr. Waldron partners with racialized communities, community-based organizations, health agencies, government, and academics to conduct research and to develop legislation, services, programs, and documentary film and other multimedia tools and resources to address health and mental health disparities and promote health equity and environmental and climate justice. For example, her research on Black women's experiences with mental health illness in the Halifax Regional Municipality led to the creation of Nova Scotia Health Sisterhood Initiative, the first health service exclusively for Black women in Nova Scotia.
Her research and advocacy on environmental racism in Black and Indigenous communities in Canada led to her co-developing with former politician Lenore Zan, the first federal private member's environmental racism / justice bill in Canada, called an act respecting the development of a national strategy to assess, prevent and address environmental racism and advance environmental justice, Bill C-226. On June 13, 2024, the bill was approved at Senate, and on June 20, it was given royal assent, becoming the first environmental justice law in Canada.
Dr. Waldron is the author of the 2018 book, There's Something in the Water, Environmental Racism in Indigenous and Black Communities, which was turned into a 2020 Netflix documentary of the same name and was co-produced by Waldron, actor Elliot Page, Ian Daniel, and Julia Sanderson, and directed by Page and Daniel. Her forthcoming book, From the Enlightenment to Black Lives Matter, Tracing the Impacts of Racial Trauma in Black Communities from the Colonial Era to the Present, will be published on November 25, 2024. It traces the history of racial trauma experienced by Black communities in Canada, the US, and the UK from the colonial era to the present.
Thank you. Welcome, Dr. Ingrid Waldron. So we're going to begin with our questions today. And we were just wondering, have you always wanted to be a professor?
Definitely not. That's the last thing I wanted to be. That came late in my life. I was a shy young woman. I had a fear of speaking in public, intense fear of speaking in public. Nowhere in my mind did I ever think I would be teaching in front of a classroom, in front of people, because of that fear. By the time I got to my PhD, I thought, well, unlike my colleagues, I don't want to be a professor. What I think I'd want to do is just kind of work with data, work with research. And I was actually thinking that maybe the ideal workplace for me would be Health Canada, where I could do research and policy work on health and sit in a little booth, you know, work with data. You know, I thought that was much more in line with my personality. It wasn't until I said to myself, let me just teach one class just to cancel it out. That was my goal. I said, you know, I keep saying I don't want to teach and I'm going to hate it, but I've never actually done it because I was never a TA. Mm-hmm. So I said, I've never done it. So let me try it. I know I'm going to hate it, but let me try it and then I'll cancel it out for sure. So this was in 2005. I applied for a part-time teaching position at the University of Toronto's Scarborough campus, a night course. And I went up to the podium, terrified. I saw 300 students looking at me. The course was on race and identity, a very interesting topic to me. I opened my mouth. I started to teach. And right then and there, I fell in love. It was the weirdest thing. My nerves, my anxiety dissipated to the point where I wouldn't say it dissipated forever, but the intense fear of speaking in public evaporated from that day on because I was there talking about something that I was passionate about. It was amazing. You know, my mother was up for vacation and I went home after that first ever teaching experience and I looked at my mother and I said, Mom, I think I found my calling. And it was my mother years ago who said to me, you know, this fear of speaking in public, you got to do something about it. You got to nip it in the bud because in any workplace that you go into, you're going to have to do some kind of speaking. So I need you to nip it in the bud. And I was thinking of all these different ways I can address it. There was a Dale Carnegie is a very well-known name in terms of helping people with public speaking. And I was kind of exploring that, but, you know, it was a bit expensive. And well, the truth is I never really needed to seek out any training because teaching has done that for me. So I was shocked as I stood there on the Scarborough campus teaching. And as I'm teaching, I am falling in love with what I thought I would hate. And from then on in, I have loved this job. I love being a professor, not just because there's teaching, but there's so many components to it. You can write books, you can write journal articles, you can go to conferences, you can do podcasts if you want. It's become so broad now in terms of what you can do, in terms of just sharing your knowledge and being creative. I never get bored. I never get demotivated. There's always something fresh and new to do. So,
wow, that is wonderful. There is a lesson right there. Don't cancel anything out until you try it. So thank you so much for those words of wisdom. So looking at the things that you studied, you did a BA in psychology. Then you went on to do an MA in intercultural education, race and ethnicity and culture. Then you did a PhD in sociology and equity studies in education. How did you decide what to study?
Yeah, it was interesting because that seems all very scattered. I would consider myself today to be an interdisciplinary scholar. So when I look back and I see all the degrees I have, it now makes sense and I'm happy I did it. But it felt like I was a bit directionless maybe in the past. I did my BA in psychology because when I was probably 15, 16 years old, I wanted to be a psychologist or a psychiatrist, child psychiatrist or child psychologist. I had an interest when I was very young in, I guess, people that I would say at that age look sad. You know, I didn't really know what it meant, but obviously depression, but I wanted to help people. And I would see probably different things on television, documentaries, commercials, and I'd see people looking sad or people having mental health issues. I was immediately drawn to that. So, and helping children as well. I had a love for children, which I still do today. So I thought being a child psychologist or a child psychiatrist definitely is what I wanted to do. So I went to McGill University and I studied psychology. But, you know, as we do, we often have a minor, and my minor was sociology. And I actually started to feel that I like sociology more than psychology. Sociology is very different. Psychology is very focused on the individual. Sociology is very focused on systems and structures. I didn't realize that you can put those two things together in those days, but I found it interesting that I started liking sociology more than psychology. I took a long break from my undergrad, and then when I decided I wanted to do my master's degree, I said to myself, I think I want to maybe focus on the underachievement or the high dropout rates of Black students in high school. And the reason I decided to kind of focus my master's degree on that is because during the kind of break from school, you know, after my undergraduate degree, I took about 7 years off and I just worked. I was watching a lot of talk shows in those days, and a lot of talk shows were showing, like American talk shows, were kind of showing a lot of Black or African-American young people who were not doing well in school, who are failing, who are dropping out. And this was something I was noticing across various talk shows, and that engaged me. I thought, dealing with the maybe under-education or dropout rate of Black students, to me, is something that I think I want to address. So when I decided to go back and do my master's degree in England, that's what I chose. I was supervised by a professor who was the leading scholar in anti-racist education in England. And the Institute of Education at the University of London, where I did my master's degree, at that time was considered the top university in that kind of work in anti-racism education. So I was lucky enough to go there. It was a one-year master's degree, thoroughly enjoyed it. And through that master's degree, I also came to know about a lot of Black feminist scholars, Black British feminist scholars who were doing work on undereducation, but from a very Black feminist perspective. And it really opened up my eyes. When it was time to come back to Canada, I decided on the University of Toronto, specifically OISE, because I had identified a professor, Dr. George Day, a Ghanaian professor, who was doing his work on the undereducation of Black youth. He had written a book about dropout, you know, Black dropouts, the underachievement of Black students in high schools. And I thought he's a perfect person because I'd started this work with my master's degree and I assumed I'd continue with that. I reached out to him and I said, I'm planning to apply to OISE, to the Sociology and Equity Studies in Education Department. If I get in, would you be willing to supervise me? I share your interests. And he said he would. I got in. I worked under him, of course. I continued to. But then halfway through, I started reading literature on mental health and the impact of racism on Black people's mental health. And I said to myself, is this a thing? Because I had experienced racism in employment in Canada, and it had a deleterious impact on my emotional health when I went up for different jobs and promotions and I didn't get it. And that's when you, as a Black person, tend to blame yourself. Well, maybe I didn't have this, and maybe I didn't have that, not really knowing what it was about, but recognizing that it could be about racism. And I started encountering, as I was looking at anti-racism education, I started to encounter a lot of American and British literature on mental health, on the impacts of racism on mental health, not knowing that this was a thing. And I said, you know what? I think I found really what I want to do. I didn't want to disappoint my supervisor. I kept him on, but he was so interested in what he was doing, which is school system and dropouts. And I thought, if I tell him I'm changing my topic, how would he feel? He didn't mind, but I changed my topic, kept it. Thank God he wanted to stay on as my supervisor. And yeah, that's when I started on this kind of road on the structural kind of determinants of health, structural inequities, racism, and the impact on your health and your mental health. When you hear that, it tells you, though, that all the things that I did before, the degrees that I did before, now kind of made sense. The psychology degree that I thought I had abandoned, you know, the psychology work I had done, I thought I had abandoned. But through the work that I was doing with my PhD, I realized that everything kind of became relevant, and that what I was doing was very interdisciplinary, but it was bringing all my passions together. And since then, I've been on that same road to be an interdisciplinary scholar that engages with sociology, equity studies, psychology, mental health, etc. And it's just been wonderful for me because I feel I can enter different spaces and have a critical understanding about the workings of structural inequities and how it impacts us in our everyday lives.
That's awesome. What a blessing to be able to draw up all of those lenses in what you're doing. And you're doing fantastic work. I really was intrigued when you mentioned University of London and England and all of that, and why you chose that, and how you were able to bring, you know, your research interest from there to Toronto and do that, but also found your own path even in that kind of space. That's amazing. You spoke about taking 7 years out after your first degree. We were just wondering, what other work did you do outside academia during that period?
Well, yeah, after my undergrad, I was just tired. You know, some people continue on immediately with their master's degree. I don't know how they do it. I was just burnt out. But I also realized I didn't like the way psychology was taught. It was Freud, and it was, you know, all the kind of forefathers of psychology from a very Euro-Western perspective. Once again, at that age, I didn't know it was Euro-Western. I didn't know there was another way. I didn't know that what I did in my PhD was another way, that I could look at racism and mental health. So I was very young, obviously, when I did my undergrad, and I thought, the way I'm being taught psychology, I'm just not interested in this, and I don't think I want to continue to pursue psychology, and I'm tired of studying right now, and I just need a break because I feel burnt out. So I took a break and I just worked. I needed work experience. So one of the first jobs I got actually was in the health field, was at the College of Physicians and Surgeons of Ontario in Toronto. It's the licensing body for doctors, and I was in the complaints department. So when you have a complaint against so they didn't do, like, they didn't sue people, sue doctors. That wasn't the body to do that. But if you had a complaint against your doctor in terms of the doctor's bedside manner, or, you know, you didn't like the way the doctor talked to you or the treatment that you've gotten, then there was an intake division where you could call in on the phone and get advice. And I was in the intake division. So people would call me and say, you know, I have a concern about my doctor. Would you listen to me and maybe give me some advice? And that was my job. If the person wanted to pursue it further, then we had what was called complaints investigators. So that as an intake officer, I would then put it forward to the complaints investigator. So I was in that job for a long time. One of the things with me is I stay at jobs for a very long time. So I stayed there for 7 years full time. Yeah, so good 7 years. And then when I decided to eventually move on, of course, to my master's degree, I went to England. I chose England because I had gone on a vacation to London, England in the early 90s and fell in love with it. So I said to myself, how do I combine a very long vacation in London with my graduate degree? Because I wanted to go back to school. And there I loved my job. I was a waitress. So as a Canadian at that time, you can work only 15 hours a week maximum. So there was a hotel across the street from my residence, and I went in, got the job, and served people breakfast part-time during my master's degree. I also did some, not babysitting, I don't know what I would call it, but I worked with an autistic child. And that time I thought, maybe autism is also something that interests me. So I worked with a six-year-old autistic child as well as a part-time job. And then when I went to the University of Toronto to pursue my PhD, I had to leave that full-time job as an intake officer, and I worked with the Kids Help Phone. Once again, still in counseling. I was a counselor at the Kids Help Phone. That you do that on the phone. What was great about that job was that it allowed me to actually write my thesis at my desk. So in between calls from children, I could write. So many of my coworkers would come to me and say, "What are you doing?" I'm doing my thesis. So it was a perfect job. It was so flexible and allowed me to write my thesis there. Nobody bothered me. Yeah, so those are kind of the jobs that I had to kind of survive while I was doing my studies.
How do you think some of those work experiences have contributed to your interest right now?
Maybe I didn't think of it at that time, but they were all jobs where I was helping people. With the autistic child, as I said, way back, I wanted to be a child psychologist. So I was kind of living out that dream, although, I didn't choose to be a child psychologist when I did my PhD. I knew that that wasn't for me, and I wanted to work with research and data. But with that autistic child, it was child psychology. With the Kids Help Phone, it was child psychology. Once again, I'm helping children and adolescents, and at times their parents would call in as well, to deal with traumatic issues. So I think in a way, it allowed me to work in spaces that focus on psychology, even though I knew that that was no longer my calling. Research was my calling, research on mental health, but not necessarily working as a practitioner or a health professional. I no longer wanted that, but it allowed me to kind of get it out of the way and get it out of my system.
That's awesome. Thank you for sharing. I really had a great laugh when you were speaking earlier about the phobia of standing in front of a crowd and just that one class. And it's very powerful that you said that because it just takes one attempt, just doing it once, and you'd find out whether it's for you. And in your case, you
Yes.
loved it. And Mama was right. Mama is always right. Just get
Yes.
it.
What we would do in high school in the classroom, the teacher would ask every student to read a passage from the book. So you would read your passage, then you give the book to somebody else. Just doing that, I was terrified. I could hear my voice trembling in class, in music class. I didn't want to sing out loud because I thought the person next to me would hear me. Like I had a real fear, and to think that teaching a university class would actually just nip that in the bud immediately with such a heavy fear, like I had a major fear, is amazing to me. And it's not to say I don't ever get nervous now, but not like that, not like how I used to.
No, thank you for sharing. So excited that you're doing this effortlessly now. How would you say that your current research and teaching interests have evolved over time?
Well, they've evolved a lot because with my PhD, it was the focus that I didn't mention had to do with Black women. So when I said I discovered all these British Black feminist scholars when I was in England, I brought that to my PhD research. So I decided that my PhD research would focus on the impact of discrimination on the mental health of Black women. So that's what I did. So I looked at Black women in Toronto who were from the continent of Africa, who were from the Caribbean, and who were Canadian born. And I looked at their experiences of mental illness and how they sought help for mental illness, and also looked at informal and formal supports that they use to address mental illness, whether it's church or religion or yoga, etc., all the different kinds of ways in which they coped and dealt with mental illness. So that's what I assumed I would continue doing because that was really my passion. I did a postdoc as well, and that postdoc continued on that same vein. I looked at Black women and mental illness, but my postdoc was a little bit more specific. Looked at coping a little bit more and perceptions of discrimination, right? People's perceptions of discrimination. So I was happy. This is my passion. I thought that's what I was going to continue to do. I did that postdoc for about 3 years. Then I saw a job at Dalhousie and I left Toronto for Halifax. And then in 2012, an environmental activist wanted to meet with me. And he had been active around, you know, environmental racism in African Nova Scotian and Indigenous communities in Nova Scotia. I had not done any work on environment. I had no interest in this area, no degrees, of course, and wondering why he's coming to talk to me. And he said, well, I looked at your website and I thought you would be good. But at that time, there's nothing on my website about anything really, because I was kind of a new scholar. So my website really had nothing on it. And it certainly didn't have anything on environment, but he sat there and he said, I'd like you to do a project on environmental racism. And I was like, huh? What? And I said, I've never heard of this. How would you describe it? So he explained it. And I thought, okay, I was still a bit confused. How could the environment be racist? It's only later when I read up on it, I realized about policy and policies can be racist. But I said yes to him because I recognized immediately this is a health issue. I am a health researcher. And if someone is worried about having a dump in their backyard, they're probably worried about getting cancer. That's immediately what I thought. And then it was an opportunity to work with Black communities there and Indigenous communities there. Now, I had been in Nova Scotia since 2008. He had approached me in 2012. But even after 4 years being in Nova Scotia, I felt it was very, very difficult to get to know the African Nova Scotian community. It is a different community. It's not an immigrant community. They've been there for 400 years. They see themselves as very unique. I didn't feel like I had made significant inroads yet into that community. You know, doing this project that he's asking me to do, or doing this whole field of research, would maybe allow me to get to know the African Nova Scotian community better. But I also always wanted to get to know the Indigenous community, and they're mostly Mi'kmaq community. So I thought, okay, I don't really know anything about the environment. It doesn't really interest me, to be honest. But what does interest me is the fact that this is ultimately a health issue. I'm a health researcher, and it would allow me to get to know these two communities. So I said yes, very hesitantly. So that was a real turn, a real twist. It's not something I ever saw coming. I mean, it's an understatement to say that I had no interest in environmental issues. I really didn't. But there again is a kind of a lesson, is that don't, you know, when they say don't throw the baby out with the bathwater, that saying, it's like, if I said no to him, I would have thrown out the opportunity to do research that was health research and to get to know communities that I wanted to get to know. And so the environment part is not my expertise. It's not what I know, but maybe it's an opportunity for me to learn. And I'm very happy that I said yes. I was close to saying no, because I've learned so much over the years. And it's also allowed me to develop partnerships. We talk about that all the time in academia, but boy, did I need partners. I needed those environmental scientists and geologists and people like that who were doing work that was so out of my expertise, to bring them on and to have them help me and to learn from them over the years. This is now 12 years that I've been doing this work, has been so exciting. And also to have students from those disciplines come on board, I've learned so much. So thank God I didn't throw the baby out with the bathwater. I've made this project very interesting for myself. I've certainly made health and mental health central to the topic of environmental racism, where I feel like a lot of professors who do work on environmental issues do not focus on health enough, but they certainly do not focus on mental health. So I think I've put a nice, unique spin on it and turned it into something that interests me and made it interesting for me specifically. And through that passion, people have been very excited. This is the topic that I'm doing, the research that I'm doing, that the public has become most excited about. But I would say that it is the environmental work that I'm doing that people are most excited about, that I get the most people coming to me to want to volunteer, to want to partner, more than any other kind of research that I'm doing. So there's a part of me, and I've always said this to people, I feel like this was kind of meant to be. When that man came to my office and he said, I want you to do this, I feel like this project has been serendipitous. It's like serendipity. All the things that have happened, the things that I've gotten through this project easily, without any effort, people that have just come to me, things that have come to me, funding that has just come to me, the Netflix documentary that just came to me, Elliot Page that just came to me. Like, it seems like with this project, things came to me easily. So I see it as serendipitous, and I see it as it was meant to be for some very strange reason. I don't know why it would come to somebody like me without any environmental science degree. But maybe it's for me to put my own spin on it, which is what I've done, right? I realized the gaps that I had in my knowledge around environmental science, but I also realized as a sociologist and somebody in health and mental health that I brought another aspect to it that I didn't feel other Canadian scholars were engaged in enough. So I made it my own.
Knowing when to say yes, that's very important. And also sometimes, as you said, things just come to you. Sometimes we plan for things, but sometimes openness for things just to come to us as scholars is very, very important. So thank you so much for sharing that. And now the communities in Nova Scotia, you said you felt almost as an outsider. How did you make inroads into these communities?
Slowly. I mean, it's slowly. Yeah. The communities might, you know, they might disagree, but I mean, this is coming from my perspective as, yes, I was Black. I shared racial background with, for example, the African Nova Scotian community, but they have a very unique historical profile, which is different from many other Black Canadians. I was born in Canada, but my parents are from the Caribbean. They're from Trinidad, and our trajectory has been very different. My parents are immigrant parents who came to Canada in the 1960s. With African Nova Scotians, they've been in Canada for 400 years. However, their background comes from the United States, you know, descendants of Black loyalists, but also, of course, the continent of Africa, so Sierra Leone, but also the Caribbean, Jamaican Maroons. So in their background, they certainly share similarities with Caribbean people and certainly people from the African continent, but they see themselves as very unique and their experiences are very unique. To be taken into the community requires a lot of patience on the part of people who are newcomers. And I felt that it took some time for me to get to know them because I think they're not always trusting, you know, they're not always trusting. And lots of people come and do research. And for some of them, the research just takes from them and it doesn't give back. And I would say that African Nova Scotians have had experience with a special brand of racism that's been really, really harsh. So they're not trusting. So you really have to make sure that if you're going to do, as many people say, I'm doing community-based research, that it truly is, because they will snuff you out very quickly, right? They can see through you. So I understood the hesitance and I understood maybe the suspicion. So I would say it took a long time to gain their trust. I think for me, what did it though, is that just as a person, I am someone who delivers. I don't make broken promises. And people have told me this, that if I say I'm going to do something, I'm going to do it. If I say I'm going to come back, I'm going to come back and complete the work. What should we say? Reliable and dependable. Somebody that has integrity. And I think those qualities that I have are key. Other qualities might be important, but if you show integrity, that you're there for the long haul, that you're coming back, that this isn't about your tenure, and that you truly want to make a change, that's where the trust comes in. And I continue to do work. I'm at McMaster now. I continue to do work in the African Nova Scotian community, giving back. So I think the community sees that, and I'm one of the people that they can trust.
Excellent qualities that you mentioned, and every researcher needs to remember those. The community wants people who have integrity, not just for the tenure. We must always make note of that.
That's what people think about us as researchers. Trust me, as professors, that's all we care about. I truly care about community. I think some of them think we really don't, but if I were just going to publish in academic journals, then move on to the next research project, and that's boring for me. I don't want an academic career like that. I find that very, very boring. Yeah. So the community part of it and the knowledge translation, like what you guys are doing here, multimedia, that's been central to my work. That's the part I love.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's very obvious that you're very passionate about this knowledge dissemination. Now, talk to us about the Netflix documentary. How did that happen?
I don't know. There's another thing that is just really interesting because, yeah, I had finished my book. My book had been published early April 2018. I was doing like what most academics do. I was doing book launches, doing book readings, you know, went to Montreal, Toronto, different places to to create awareness about my book. And then at the end of 2018, I went to my Twitter page and I noticed a new follower. Didn't think anything of it. This is my Enrich Twitter page. Enrich is that project I set up after that activist came to me in my office to tell me to take on this project in environmental racism. So I had this project called the Enrich Project. Anything that I did having to do with the environment would be under that name. So I had a Twitter page for Enrich and I went on it and I noticed a new follower. Thought, new follower, didn't think anything of it, like we all do, right? Mm-hmm. So I went away and I never really went on to that page. I had my personal Twitter page I was typically more active on. So 4 weeks later, I go back to the Enrich Twitter page and I'm like, this page is very active and somebody's promoting my book and people are talking about my book and people are talking about the Enrich Project and people are talking about the women on the front lines of environmental justice organizing and what is going on. How come this Twitter page is so active all of a sudden? So then I traced it back up to the person who was following me 4 weeks. I saw the name Elliot Page, but it didn't hit. You know, it didn't hit that this was the actor, the movie star whose movie, Juno, I had seen twice in 2007 and didn't know the person on the screen was Canadian. But I remember thinking to myself, because he was on the movie screen with big time actors like Jennifer Garner. And I remember saying to myself, whoever this actor is blowing everybody off the screen. This actor is so natural. And I went to see the movie a second time and it didn't hit. And then later on, it did hit. I said, could this be Elliot Page, actor in Juno, the X-Men, the movie with Leonardo DiCaprio? And it hit me and I said, yes. And in shock, you know, I'm thinking, why is he promoting my book? I had no idea he was any kind of activist or interested in environmental issues. So I realized it was him. And I said, well, the least I can do is thank him because he is promoting my book, which just came out this year. So I DM'd him on Twitter and I said, hello, Elliot, this is Ingrid. I just want to thank you for what you've been doing. You've been promoting my book, The Enrich Project, and supporting the women on the front lines. I really, really want to thank you. And he got back to me and said, I'm just trying to find a way to use my platform to help. Mm-hmm. And then I happened to connect with an old friend of his, which I didn't know at that time was a friend, but I was on some environmental committee at that time with a friend of his who had been a friend of his for 15 years. And I think I mentioned it, not knowing they were friends. I said, oh, Elliot Page, blah, blah, blah. And the friend said, Elliot Page, oh, I've known Elliot for 15 years. Do you want me to connect you to maybe on the phone? And I said, would you? And she said, yes. And we had at the end of 2018, a three-way call where we try to just think of ideas of how Elliot's celebrity platform could advance this issue of environmental racism in the public domain. We didn't really settle on anything. So we agreed to meet again on the phone in 2019, January, this time with some of the women I had been working with around environmental racism. And that's when we decided, at that time, not on a documentary film, but on 10-minute clips. 10-minute clips we can throw onto Twitter. That's all we came up with, you know? We thought, oh, you know, we want to create awareness about environmental racism. What better way to do that than put some clips, video clips on Twitter? And that's what we had settled on. Elliot came up to Nova Scotia. I was living there at the time, to Halifax for about 6 days and filmed me first in my apartment, my condo, living room, and then filmed the other people within that 6 days. And then I was invited back to Elliot's mother's home to watch the full video. Now, they had 70 minutes or more, but that's not what they were planning to go with. It was going to be like short clips. But then I'm seeing people on the screen in this documentary that they were doing for my project crying. And I thought, I don't think 10-minute clips on Twitter is going to do this justice because you got people getting all emotional. So I was the one who just said, can we turn this into a documentary of about 70 minutes? And the co-director said, Ian Daniel, he said, you mean like a full-fledged documentary? And I said, yes. I said, I think it's too important to have it just slap onto Twitter. And that's when I started going crazy. I started saying, we could take it to the Toronto Film Festival and we can take it to the Berlin Film Festival and we can take it to the Venice. I went crazy because I'm such a documentary fan and I used to volunteer with Toronto International Film Festival. I love film festivals. And they said, really, Ingrid, you're serious? I said, yes. I said, You know, if we want awareness, what better way? We have it at a film festival, but also people from all over the world are coming to the Toronto Film Festival. Like, what better awareness? What better knowledge translation, as we say in academia? This is the tops. They all agree, thankfully, and they rushed to get it into TIFF, and it got in. And we eventually screened it. We premiered it on September 9th, 2019 at the Elgin Theatre in Toronto. That's the story of this. It's just shocking to me. I can say, I don't mention this often to people, but I will say that after my book came out, I did a little prayer. I was just about to go to sleep. I was in my bed and I talked to God out loud, which I do sometimes. And I said, and I, to this day, I think it has had an impact because it's a weird thing to ask God for. And it happened. But I said to God, please make something very, very special happen around my book. I remember saying that. Please make something very special and big happen around my book, because my book had just come out that year. And I closed my eyes, went to sleep. And then I would say probably 3 weeks later, that's when I noticed Elliot following me on Twitter.
Thank you so much for sharing that. It also encourages other academics not to only do research and publish in journals, peer-reviewed journals, full stop, but also imagine beyond the academic community. If we are thinking about broadening the audiences of our research findings.
Thank you.
Having taught at university for almost two decades now, what would you say is your teaching philosophy?
Well, the first thing is my class provides opportunities for students to talk and engage with critical thinking. That's really key. It seems very normal, but I've had students say to me, "Thank you, Dr. Waldron, for letting us talk," which I think is weird. So I don't know if the other professors have a lecture style where they just do all the talking, but I remember my PhD supervisor, George Day, saying when he was my supervisor, but when he was also teaching me, saying, students come with knowledge, right? Because you can be a professor standing up there thinking, I've got all the knowledge. I'm the expert. I'm the teacher. You guys listen to me, right? Mm-hmm. But I remember him saying, you know, humbly, and he had written so many books, and he said, everybody comes with knowledge. Students come with knowledge. And my classrooms are a platform for students to share their thoughts and feelings and to critically analyze and get deep under the skin of various theories and make them their own and make them real. So I may throw out questions, but I want students to take up the space. So I give my lectures, yes, but most of it is giving students space to work through their understandings of critical theories and apply them to the real world. So because I deal with, some people would say, tough topics, I don't consider them necessarily tough, but they're considered tough, issues of racism, sexism, transphobia, issues related to sexual orientation. You know, I'm dealing with isms and inequality that might be difficult for some students in the classroom. Some students I notice get uncomfortable. I try to make it very, well, I don't know if I would say comfortable, but to teach it in a way that students can digest it, to break it down, make it their own, and apply it to their real world experiences. And it doesn't matter who you are. If you're a member of a racialized group or not, and if you're not a member of a minoritized or racialized group, I find ways for you to understand the experiences of racialized peoples through the disadvantages that you, for example, as a white person, also experiences, right? Because white people, while they may have white skin privilege, they may also be disabled. They may also be low income. They may also be trans, right? So in order to get different students to understand the experiences of different people, I think it's important for them to center on their experiences where they do not have privilege, to work through that and to be able to understand other people's disadvantages. Because sometimes it's very hard, for example, for a white student to understand racism. But if I'm able to identify where they feel disadvantaged and to have them work through that, then perhaps they come closer to understanding somebody of another racial group's disadvantage. So it's kind of an exercise in my classroom on critical thinking about various isms, about structural inequities, and applying it to real world lived experiences and giving them the platform to do that. Of course, it's moderated. So if anybody's saying anything that's out of hand or inappropriate, certainly I will check on that. But I think students in my class appreciate the fact that as one student says, you let us talk. My classroom is also very interactive. So I've got classroom exercises, case studies, film. I like to always start with a short 10-minute film that pertains to the theme of that session on that day. Lectures no more than 20 minutes, classroom exercise with small groups, share back to large group, and then a large discussion later. So I think one thing I've learned is that every 20 minutes, you change to something else. Somebody told me that. So if you're lecturing for 20 minutes, change now to a class exercise and then change again to keep it fresh and interesting.
Thank you so much. So many words on marble here. Let the students talk. Thank you for letting us talk. Sounds like the title of a new journal article. So, Dr. Waldron, if you were to give advice to your younger self, say at 21, what would that advice be?
You know, I spent a lot of my young life feeling unmotivated. And my mother was always concerned about that. Ingrid, how come you're always unmotivated? You need to be motivated. Why do you get so bored so quickly? I was always bored. I never thought I would find my path. You know, I would have jobs, be excited and passionate for 3 months and then get bored. And I never understood that. It's only when I found teaching that I never became bored again. I've not been bored since. I think I'll tell my young self to not be so anxious about finding a path immediately. For some people, that happens quickly, and that is great. For me, it took much longer in life to find the path where everything came together. And maybe some of us need that time. Maybe there's a part of me that wishes that I had found that path a little earlier. But the way it's come together so beautiful that I think if I didn't experience all the things that I did, maybe stayed away from education for 7 years and decided to work, try different types of disciplines, different types of jobs, I don't think I'd be able to bring everything that I'm bringing together right now to my research area, to the scholarship that I'm doing now. So I would say to my younger self, be patient. Don't be so anxious. Things will work out. And, you know, when you said mothers know everything, my mother said that to me when I was doing my PhD. And I came home kind of frustrated because I wanted things to happen now. She said to me, and I just thought this is a mother just trying to placate me. But she said to me, it'll come. It'll come. And I rolled my eyes. I'm like, oh, that's what a mother would say. It'll come. When is it going to happen? And it came. And it came in such a beautiful way. I'm so happy with what I'm doing. I've never been bored, ever. This was an issue for me. This was a chronic issue for me, being bored and unmotivated in my early teen years, 14, 15, always bored, always ready to move on to the next thing. And ever since I found my calling, which is teaching, I have never been bored. So for young people out there, go on the journey. Don't be anxious. Don't be impatient. As long as your instincts are telling you that this is something that you like, continue on that journey. It may look haphazard when you look back. It looks like you're doing different things that don't make sense, which is what I thought. I looked at my resume and I said, this doesn't really make sense with this. Now when I look back, everything makes sense. But I didn't know when I was on that journey that it was making sense. But now everything makes sense. That's my advice to my younger self.
Sometimes in the moment, it looks like it's haphazard. It's not making sense. But I really love that. Just keep doing what you need to do. It will make sense. So thank you so much for sharing that. And I'm thinking about Ellie career colleagues, what advice would you give somebody who's just gotten a tenure track job?
Collaborations and get to know people. It's so easy to get stuck in your little corner and do your research, which is kind of tempting, right? Because there's so many competing kind of demands. You do have to, yes, get your grants and you got to do your teaching well and get good evaluations. You can get stuck in a little corner, obsessed with that and never meet anybody. It's really important for a lot of reasons, for mentorship. Find people with your interest inside the university, outside the university, at other universities, people to collaborate with on grants, and people who are potential mentors. I was advised that by, I think it was the VP of research when I was at Dalhousie, and I maybe slightly dismissed it. I thought to myself, oh, I'll do it by myself. I'm strong. I'll do it by myself. And he said to me, and he was a white man, you know, and he was right. I think this is specifically important for Black folks. He said, find mentorship, Ingrid, find mentorship. And yeah, I dismissed it. I thought, well, what do I need that for? I can do it on my own. I'm strong. And then I realized as I went along, it doesn't matter how strong you are. We all need mentorship. It doesn't matter how self-reliant and resourceful, all the things that I thought I was. It's very hard to get through, get your tenure, get all the things you need to do without mentorship. I see it now clearly. It's going to take you longer. He said that to me. It'll take you longer if you don't get mentorship. So for youngsters, don't get stuck in your little room working with your data. Get out there, meet people, go to events, speak to people, be open to meeting with them. You know, I say to people about my Enrich project, when I was in Nova Scotia, so many people said to me, can I meet with you? Can I come to your office? Just like the guy, the environmental activist, he was one of many that I said yes to. I say that when I do many of my presentations. I said yes all the time when I was in Nova Scotia. You want to meet with me in my office? Yes. And ultimately, when I met with people, they took me down a different path. Just like the guy, the environmental activist. Didn't he take me down a different path in environmental work that I never even ventured into? But beyond that, even in the environmental field, people will say, can I meet with you? I have an idea. And if I had dismissed them, I wouldn't have the wonderful water testing project and the water testing NGO that I co-founded in 2017 with a geologist of all things. Did I ever think I'd be working with a geologist? I'm a sociologist, right? So in Nova Scotia, that was my practice. Yes, 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 yes. Of course, you're busy, etc. I was always busy, but I never was too busy to say, yes, I'd be interested in meeting with you in my office. So find time and space for people and not just facts and figures.
Thank you so much, Ingrid. Those are words on marble. Moving away from work, how do you relax?
I love movies. I love dancing. I like festivals. There was the Korean festival in Toronto last week. There's a Trinidad, because my parents are from Trinidad, so there's a Trinidad and Tobago festival this weekend. I love festivals. I love street parades. I love theater. I love plays, musical theater. I love travel. I love music. I love rock concerts. I love the arts. I really, really love the arts, which is why I'm so excited to kind of be back in Ontario, close enough to in Toronto that I can enjoy the arts in Toronto because it's so huge. So that's what I would say. I love creative things and I love the arts and I love music, listening to music. I love to relax. I like being out. I love being outdoors.
Which destination is among your favorite destinations to go to?
Well, I can just talk about the ones I've been to that I would love to go back to. I mean, I've been to Paris twice or three times. Love to go back. London, England, where I studied, I went there because I loved it so much. I want to go back to London. I haven't been there so long. You know, in the past, it was about Europe, but right now I have this interest in like Asia, South Korea, Japan. It's such a different culture that, yeah, I have this kind of thing right now. I want to see different parts of Asia and South Asia and Southeast Asia. That's where I'd like to go next.
For most of these places that you visited, or maybe back home here, what's your favorite food?
I like Italian food. I love pasta with chicken and vegetables. I love that. In terms of Trinidadian food, my mother's food, so palau, which is rice, and it's mixed with, you probably have that in different parts of Africa. It's mixed with vegetables. And then what we call stew chicken. So the chicken is so juicy. The chicken is like, you can see the juice running off the bone. So that's what my mother used to cook. And I love roti, which is also a Trinidadian classic. We've got a kind of Indian community in Trinidad and roti comes from that. So it's like almost like a tortilla type of thing with chicken stuffed in it. You can have pumpkin inside it. You can have peas. Yes.
What is your favorite quotation?
I have many. One of them I used to put on my email, but I don't have it on my email anymore. I wish I can remember. But one of them is, life is what you make it. And I truly believe that you have control over your life and that your, and I know this sounds very new agey, but your thoughts control your life. And I've seen it. And I've seen negative people around me who are very pessimistic and they're negative and only negative things keep happening to them. And for me, it's not, I don't have a fake positivity. I really am positive. I wake up every morning thinking I have a fresh new start because God allowed me to wake up. And I find that when I'm positive things come to me. They happen to me. I'm not naturally pessimistic and I'm not naturally negative. So I don't know what that's like. But I think life is about what you make it, and it's very easy to get wrapped into what people do to us and a sense of victimhood, particularly if you're Black. I get it, you know, because there are things that we do experience systemic racism. But despite all of that, I try to rise above it and to stay positive, to go after the things that I want to go after, even though, once again, I know that as a Black person, I might be restricted. I'm never going to deny that as a Black person, that maybe some of my big dreams will not come to pass because it's not time yet for Black people to have those opportunities. And they will come maybe for people in another generation after mine. So I realize that there might be restrictions on my life because of gender and race. Despite that, sometimes I just don't even see it. I don't think about race. I know because that's my scholarship. That's what I do in terms of research. But sometimes I actually think that, no, it's not even going to touch me. I can get anything I want. I think if you can dream big and understand that life is what you make it and what you go after and how you think, regardless of the restrictions on your life, I actually think you can break. Wow. So I want young people to think that I understand the racism. I understand all those challenges. You've got to go after it. It has to be about what you make it. How do you mold your life? Forget about other people. Forget about the negativity. Go after what you want. Think about it. Think through it. Just like I did when I spoke to God that night. And I said I wanted something big to happen around my book. It's about you. It's what you put into it. And if you're not spiritual, that's fine. It's about speaking. When they say speaking power, speaking words out loud, I really think there's some power in that. When you speak words out loud, when you think about what you want and you put it out there, I think it's heard. And I think it comes back to you.
What an awesome way to wrap this up. Thank you so much, Dr. Waldron. It's been such an honor. Thanks to Mama for all she did to help you nip it in the bud. We have yes. her to thank.
Thank you so much.
That is all we had in this episode.
Join us next time.
And be sure to follow us on our various social media platforms. The Black Professors Podcast was established in the summer of 2023 as a space to share the often untold stories by Black professors who take us behind the scenes of their career trajectories. The co-executive producers of the Black Professors Podcast are
Dr. Selina Mudavanu, Communication Studies and Media Arts Department, McMaster University,
and Dr. Motilola Akinfemisoye Adejare, African Studies Program, University of Calgary. The production team includes undergraduate and graduate students.
The title of the track used in the podcast is Podcast Hip Hop Intro Short by Corporate Sounds, accessed via Jamendo. Our sincere gratitude to the Pulse Lab at McMaster University for graciously allowing us to use the podcast recording equipment. The Black Professors Podcast is supported by generous funding from McMaster University's Arts Research Board.